So we continue on the chapter of practices and perspectives. First one of those, and then what we're doing is speaking of a gradual training. The path produces many subsidiary benefits that can easily be a distraction or sidetrack, but Nibbana was certainly the primary purpose for the Buddha's commitment to sharing these ways of practicing. And it's a quote from Majjhima 29, which is the Mahasaropama Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Heartwood. So this holy life, bhikkhus, this is kind of a wrap-up at the end of the sutta. So this holy life, bhikkhus, does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable deliverance of mind that is the goal of this holy life, its heartwood and its end. I think it's an important aspect. There are these benefits that do arise from practice, gain, honor, renown, the blessings of living a virtuous life, the blessings that come from having peaceful states of mind to be able to dwell in meditative attainments, and the aspects of wisdom and understanding and knowledge and vision. But none of those are the point, the possibilities, but the unshakable deliverance of mind, in Pali, akupa jeta vimutti, which is that sense of akupa, it's a firm, solid, unshakable. That is what is really important. Then the next quote comes from Majjhima 24, the Ratta Vinita Sutta, which is the discourse on the relay chariots. Friend, when asked, "But friend, is it for the sake of purification of virtue that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One?" You replied, "No, friend." When asked, "Then is it for the sake of purification of mind?" And you replied, "No, friend." When asked, "Is it for the purification of view, for the purification by overcoming doubt, for the purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path, or for purification by knowledge and vision of the way, or for purification by knowledge and vision that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One?" In that sense, is it the sake of for those things that the holy life is lived? You replied, "No, friend." "For the sake of what then, friend, is the holy life lived under the Blessed One?" "Friend, it is for the sake of final Nibbana without clinging that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One." So the discourse is being given. That was Purnamantaniputta. He comes from a different part of the country. And then Sariputta goes to question him. Purnamantaniputta belonged to a Brahmin family that came from a different region, but he was ordained by Anyakandanya, where he continued to reside until he decided to visit the Buddha at Savatthi. He lived in Kapilavatthu, and I think, if I remember correctly, I think Purnamantaniputta was Ananda's preceptor? Am I making that up? Anyway, I didn't look it up. But he's esteemed by his companions in the holy life, and then Sariputta has heard this praise being given of Purnamantani, and so then Sariputta goes and questions Purnamantani on aspects of Dhamma, and then they're talking and chatting. What is the essence of the path, or of the whole, why is the holy life lived under the Buddha's teachings? And when he describes that, he clarifies it by giving a simile of these relay chariots, where rather than there being one chariot going from Savatthi to Saketa, which is quite a distance away, it relies on these seven relay chariots where you you go along and you change horses and then you continue. And that is the simile that he gives. He said, by means of the first relay chariot, he would arrive at the second relay chariot. Then he would dismount from the first chariot and mount the second chariot. And by means of the second chariot, he would arrive at the third chariot. So he's giving that same image and simile that it's like the purification of mind leads to the purification of view. Purification of view leads into purification by overcoming doubt. Purification of overcoming doubt leads into knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path. And then that leads into purification by knowledge and vision of the way. And then that sort of takes one to purification by knowledge and vision that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One. Then that is what takes one to final Nibbana without clinging. So it's just the nature of the path. Yes, there are these different aspects of the path that one cultivates, and they're interrelated, but then they perform a function of helping to send one on one's way. And then at the end of the sutta, after Punamantani Buddha has clarified his understanding of how the path and how it leads to the goal, then Sariputta asked the Venerable Punamantani Buddha, what is the Venerable One's name? How do companions in the holy life know the Venerable One? He said, my name is Punna, friend, and my companions in the holy life know me as Mantani Buddha. And then he says, it's wonderful, it's marvelous how each question's been answered point by point, and it's a gain for the companions in the holy life, and blah, blah, blah. He praises him to his face. And then when this was said, so it's because Punamantani came from a distant land and showed up at Savatthi, and Punamantani Buddha asked the Venerable Sariputta, and what is the Venerable One's name, and how do his companions in the holy life know the Venerable One? My name is Upatissa, friend, and my companions in the holy life know me as Sariputta. Indeed, friend, we did not know that we were talking with the Venerable Sariputta, the disciple who is like the teacher himself. If we had known that this was the Venerable Sariputta, we should not have said so much. It is wonderful, friend, it is marvelous. Each profound question has been posed point by point by the Venerable Sariputta, and is a gain for his companions in the holy life, gain for them, that they have the opportunity to see and honor the Venerable Sariputta. And it is a gain for us, a great gain for us, that we have the opportunity to see and honor the Venerable Sariputta. And then the sutta ends, thus it was that these two great beings rejoiced in each other's good words. Very beautiful wrapping up. And continuing with the idea of this gradual training, the Buddha gives a lovely description of the gradual process of training by comparing it to the refining of gold. Given the right conditions, gold is pure, but it still can have impurities that require a process of refining. Similarly, although the mind is inherently pure and Nibbana is, quote-unquote, apparent here and now, it requires a process by which the obstructions can be cleared away. And this is from Anguttara 3's Sutta 100. And that's translated by Jnanaponika and Bhikkhu Bodhi. There are, O monks, gross impurities in gold, such as earth and sand, gravel and grit. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it thoroughly. When he has done this, there still remain moderate impurities in the gold, such as fine grit and coarse sand. Then the goldsmith or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When he has done this, there still remain minute impurities in the gold, such as fine sand and black dust. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the washing, and thereafter only the gold dust remains. He now pours the gold into a melting pot, smelts it, and melts it together. But he does not yet take it out from the vessel, as the dross has not yet been entirely removed, and the gold is not yet quite pliant, workable, and bright. It is still brittle, and does not yet lend itself easily to molding. But a time comes when the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the smelting thoroughly so that the flaws are entirely removed. The gold is now quite pliant, workable, and bright. It lends itself easily to molding. Whatever ornament the goldsmith now wishes to make of it, be it a diadem, earrings, a necklace, or a golden chain, the gold can now be used for that purpose. It is similar, monks, with a monk devoted to the training in the higher mind. There are in him gross impurities, namely bad conduct of body, speech, and mind. Such conduct an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes. When he has abandoned these, there are still impurities of a moderate degree that cling to him, namely, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and violent thoughts. Such thoughts an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes. When he has abandoned these, there are still some subtle impurities that cling to him, namely, thoughts about his relatives, his home country, and his reputation. Such thoughts an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes. When he has abandoned these, there still remain thoughts about higher mental states experienced in meditation. That concentration is not yet peaceful and sublime. It has not attained to full tranquility, nor has it achieved mental unification. It is maintained by strenuous suppression of the defilements. But there comes a time when his mind becomes inwardly steadied, composed, unified, and concentrated. That concentration is then calm and refined. It has attained to full tranquility and achieved mental unification. It is not maintained by strenuous suppression of the defilements. Then, to whatever mental state realizable by direct knowledge, he directs his mind. He achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge, whenever necessary conditions obtain. So there's another sutta that uses that same simile. And these are actually close to each other. It's numbered a bit differently in this compilation, which is a more recent translation. I think when we were doing these compilations, this Anguttara had only just come out. So this is Anguttara Sri, the one I just read. Ajahn Chah translates it as the dirt washer. It's translated here as the soil remover. And then the next one is numbered as Anguttara Sri 101. And the following sutta, 102, is a goldsmith. When a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to three marks. Marks are, in Pali it's called nimitta. So marks is, I guess, okay. Nimitta is sign, appearance. But it's a hard one to translate because it's used in different ways sometimes. Ajahn Jeff translates it as theme, actually, so which is good, especially in the context of this sutta. A theme is a good, you should give attention to three themes. But because I'm reading Bhikkhu Bodhi's, he uses marks, so both have a validity, of course. From time to time, he should give attention to the mark of concentration. From time to time to the mark of exertion, from time to time to the mark of equanimity, or theme of concentration, theme of exertion, theme of equanimity. If a bhikkhu devoted to the higher mind attends exclusively to the mark of concentration, it is possible that his mind will veer toward laziness. If he attends exclusively to the mark of exertion, it is possible that his mind will veer toward restlessness. If he attends exclusively to the mark of equanimity, it is possible that his mind will not be properly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. But when a bhikkhu devoted to the higher mind from time to time gives attention to the mark of concentration, from time to time to the mark of exertion, and from time to time to the mark of equanimity, His mind becomes malleable, wieldy, and luminous, pliant, and properly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. Suppose, bhikkhus, a goldsmith or his apprentice would prepare a furnace, heat up the crucible, take some gold with tongs, and put it into the crucible. Then from time to time he would blow on it, from time to time sprinkle water over it, and from time to time just look on. If the goldsmith or his apprentice were to exclusively blow on the gold, it is possible that the gold would just burn up. If we were to exclusively sprinkle water on the gold, it is possible that the gold would cool down. If we were exclusively to just look on, it is possible the gold would not reach the right consistency. But if the goldsmith or his apprentice from time to time blows on it, from time to time sprinkles water over it, and from time to time just looks on, the gold would become malleable, wieldy and luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then, whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So too, when a bhikkhu is devoted to the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to three marks. From time to time, he should give attention to the mark of concentration, from time to time to the mark of exertion, from time to time to the mark of equanimity. If a bhikkhu devoted to the higher mind attends exclusively to the mark of concentration, it is possible that his mind will veer toward laziness. If he attends exclusively to the mark of exertion, it is possible that his mind will veer toward restlessness. If he attends exclusively to the mark of equanimity, it is possible that his mind will not be properly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. But when, from time to time, he gives attention to the mark of concentration, from time to time to the mark of exertion, and from time to time to the mark of equanimity, his mind becomes malleable, wieldy, and luminous, not brittle, but properly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. Then, there being a suitable basis, he is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge through which he might incline his mind. So those are suttas that are pointing to gradual practice, gradual training, gradual path. Any questions? Yeah.
Could this also be related to like practicing Anapanasati? So if like watching the breath, but if the mind kind of is becoming too kind of spacey.
Too diffuse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it applies to all aspects of the path. And Anapanasati, of course, is a very tangible aspect to apply it to, but it could be just as easily applied to cultivation of Brahma Viharas or cultivation of Asubha Gamatana. One in meditation practice, but in how we apply practice in terms of, like we were talking about yesterday, of devotion to wakefulness. You can get too equanimous, you can get too energetic, there's this sense of balance. And it's actually, like Ajahn Chah, in another way, one of the ways he described Dhamma is that which is just right. And so it's just this sense of, is it one thing or is another? Is it just this? And we're always looking. The mind tends to be looking for that, so we can be right and not have to be wrong. Ajahn Chah said, no, it's just this just right quality. It's in Thai, na padi. It's a just right. Ajahn Kinnerly, he used to talk about just right all the time. And practice in a way. Ajahn Kinnerly was one of Ajahn Chah's main teachers, and another teacher was Ajahn Tonglen. He said, Dhamma is neither high nor low, not dark or light, not tall or short. It's just right. In Thai,
Oi, tamma ga bo sung bo dam bo dam bo khao bo ya bo san phari phari la. Yeah.
In terms of the practice, how do you know, like, okay, I'm tend to like lazy or restless, or how do you like any guide?
One is that description of the mind. The mind becomes malleable, wieldy, luminous, not brittle, but it's properly concentrated. Because that's a description of, these are words that actually describe samadhi in many, many places. Malleable, wieldy, luminous, pliant, properly fit for work. I think it's Uchu. I'm sure I've written it down somewhere. Yeah, so evang samahite jitte pari suddhe pari yodahate anankane vikattu upakele se muddhu butte kammaniye titte anancha patte jnana dasanaya chittang api niharati api ninnameti. With his mind thus concentrated, purified and bright, unblemished, free from defects, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, it directs and inclines it to knowledge and vision. So that's a standard. Yeah, when their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge and vision. The descriptions are giving one, because again, you have to come back to experience and pay attention to, okay, is the mind, because sometimes it can be too bright, it's not so steady. So these different balances are needed. It is interesting, that sense of workable, kamaniye, ready for work. It's like it's ready to apply itself to the task of, say, of investigation or of studying, whatever is appropriate. But it's also, it's pliable. A muddu is soft and pliable, adaptable. So there's these different qualities we have to pay attention to and say, what's the mind like? And that's where we have to prod the mind to investigate. Because oftentimes, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, you know. When am I going to get peaceful and get enlightened? So, just waiting for the blazing bolt of insight to come.
That seems to just really emphasize the quality of sampajanya, clear comprehension.
Yes.
Like to know really what's going on.
Yes, yes.
Not just to get absorbed
yes.
into something.
Yes, yes. That sense of, and, you know, it's really interesting. Like Lopo Samedo, he'll talk about the nature of the mind a lot. But then when people have tried to pin him down as to, well, what would that be? He said, well, sati sampajanya. You know, that's the nature of the mind that we need to rely on. So there's awareness, there's clarity, but it's also, there's an investigative quality that's part of it. Yeah?
Typically, it seems that Longpo Samedo encourages us to, he uses a much more passive kind of language and kind of like letting the defilements die by reach samadhi, then eventually these things will dissolve or erode. A much more passive language.
Yep.
And lately I've come across some teachings from Ajahn Jeff and even from Ajahn Chah that use language that's much more aggressive, like even go to war with your defilements.
Yep.
Perhaps kill or destroy.
Yep.
Which seems kind of contradictory to me. So I was...
Yeah, well, a lot of it is what's just right. What's the balance? I think Ajahn Sumedho's experience, for himself, as well as in teaching over a long time, is that getting Westerners to get obsessed about perfection is not a helpful prod or encouragement. and say, how do you get them to relax a bit more? How do you keep them from being so sort of wound tight? Now that is really an important balance. There's an occasion when Ajahn Chah was asked by a Westerner and saying that, I noticed, Lumpa, that you tend to scold the Thai monks more. You don't scold the Westerner so much. And he said, it would be really good to receive some of those tough teachings from Lumpa. He said, you guys do that to yourself all the time. I don't need to do it. So you've got this inner dialogue going on that's, oftentimes not so helpful. Yeah.
We're from Thailand, we are very known, we could be very extremely relaxed.
Yeah.
So we need a little bit more push.
Sabai, sabai. May palai. Pung li ga dai. Yeah.
Back in, I think it was the Winter Retreat 2014, we were reading from the Thai forest tradition, and someone, I made a very astute observation that I found helpful. I think it's like Lungta Mahabua talks about you destroy the defilements.
Yeah.
Ajahn Chah tended not to use that language. Ajahn Chah would say the Dhamma.
Yeah, yeah.
The Dhamma is what...
undoes the defilements. That's what, yeah. So it's like aligning oneself with Dhamma is but yeah, Lopa Cha could be pretty forceful sometimes. But yeah, it's quite interesting. I think that's quite true. That Ajahn Chah would rarely speak in personal terms. And really trying to get people to how do we really take Dhamma as a refuge? How do we give ourselves to the Dhamma? Okay. The gradual nature of the path needs to be recognized in order to summon the appropriate spiritual resources. The foremost of these is patience, not the patience of mindlessly enduring something, waiting for it to find the end, but rather of applying a steady clarity of attention to the path without shrinking back or running away from its inherent obstacles. Having made the commitment to train ourselves, we need to follow through with consistency and determination. The fruits of the training do not magically appear. They reveal themselves in their own time, requiring a skillful, steady application of effort. This quote is from Majjhima 70, which is Kitagiri Sutta. I say of such bhikkhus who are in higher training, whose minds have not yet reached the goal, and who are still aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when those venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate with good friends and balance their spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for these bhikkhus, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. Bhikkhus, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. On the contrary, final knowledge is achieved by gradual training, by gradual practice, by gradual progress. And how does there come to be gradual training, gradual practice, gradual progress? Here one who has faith in a teacher visits him. When he visits him, he pays respect to him. When he pays respect to him, he gives ear. One who gives ear hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it. He examines the meaning of the teachings he has memorized. When he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of those teachings. When he has gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, zeal springs up in him. When zeal has sprung up, he applies his will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives, resolutely striving. He realizes with the body the ultimate truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. So that's a very detailed or clear aspect of the this gradual training, gradual practice that that is bears fruit. Is there any questions with that? Yeah.
I think I heard you say he realizes with the body.
Yes.
And I thought I read in one of the suttas that arahants touch nirvana with their body.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if you might elaborate a little bit on that.
I can only speculate. But I'd say this is, like, the goal is not just a thought. It's not just a thought, oh, I've realized nirvana. It's like, this is a whole being that experiences it fully. It transforms one's whole being. That would be my take on it. Yeah?
Yesterday, I think you mentioned that arahants as well take on some of these practices of cultivation that are named in the gradual path. Was that correct?
Oh, yeah.
So what is happening in the cultivation or mind if they're meditating?
What, pardon?
What's happening in their cultivation or mind?
They keep the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
They abide in mindfulness and clear comprehension. They use their requisites skillfully. Mm-hmm. But it's all part of the path. They sit down and you know, it's like, oh, I've attained arahantship. Oh, I don't have to meditate anymore. I said, wow, I've awakened. God, I can sit here and really enjoy my meditation now. it's a different way of holding it. Because how else are you going to live your life? I've realized awakening. You know, I'll go to all those concerts I missed. I mean, it's not how it works. Does that make sense?
It does. I think I'm thinking as you're going through all these instructions about, like, finding the balance of concentration energy, that's not necessarily something they're working with. So what you just...
Right. So they're not working with it, but they're delighting in it. Yes, we're still working with it. Yeah, it's a whole different ball game. I wanted to read the Kitagiri Sutta because, I mean, one, there's these aspects of the training, but there's actually also some really interesting aspects of Sangha life in the time of the Buddha. And there's a whole alternate template of realization in the Kitagiri Sutta that's quite interesting, as well as the role and the importance of faith, of saddha. To me, it's an interesting sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Kasi country together with a large Sangha bhikkhus. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, I abstain from eating at night. By so doing, I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, bhikkhus, abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding." So this is a fairly early stage of the development of the Sangha. In the Vinaya, there's the stories of monks going pindabad at night and ending up scaring people. As well as just the complications of monks wandering around day and night looking for food. Okay, yes, Venerable Sir. "Then, as the Blessed One was wandering by stages in Kasi country, he eventually arrived at a Kasi town called Kitagiri. There he lived in this Kasi town, Kitagiri. Now, on that occasion, the bhikkhus led by Asaji and Punabasaka were residing at Kitagiri." And these were bhikkhus led by Asaji and Punabasaka are described as, quote-unquote, unscrupulous and depraved, and are shown indulging in various kinds of bad conduct that corrupt the laity. At Kitagiri, an act of banishment was pronounced against them, and their refusal to obey led to the promulgation of the rule Sangadisesa 13. So they're not exemplary monks. Then a number of bhikkhus went and told them, "Friends, the Blessed One and the Sangha bhikkhus now abstain from eating at night. By so doing, they are free from illness and affliction, and they enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, friends, abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding." When this was said, the bhikkhus led by Asachi and Punabasuka told those bhikkhus, "Friends, we eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day outside the proper time. By so doing, we are free from illness and affliction, and we enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Why should we abandon a benefit visible here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day outside the proper time." Since the bhikkhus were unable to convince the bhikkhus led by Asaji and Punabasuka, they went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told him all that had occurred, adding, "Venerable Sir, since we were unable to convince the bhikkhus led by Asaji and Punabasuka, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One." Then the Blessed One addressed the certain bhikkhu thus, "Come, bhikkhus, tell the bhikkhus led by Asaji and Punabasuka in my name that the teacher calls them." "Yes, Venerable Sir," he replied, and went to the bhikkhus led by Asaji and Punabasuka and told them, "The teacher calls you, friends." "Yes, friend," they replied, and they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then said, "Bhikkhus, is it true that when a number of bhikkhus went and told you, 'Friends, the Blessed One and the Sangha now abstain from eating at night,'" and this is, of course, ellipses in here, "'come, friends, abstain from eating at night,' you told those bhikkhus, 'Friends, we eat in the evening, we eat in the morning, we eat in the... why should we abandon a benefit visible here now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day outside the proper time.' 'Yes, Venerable Sir.' 'Bhikkhus, have you known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Whatever this person experiences, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase.' 'No, Venerable Sir.' 'Bhikkhus, have you not known me to teach the Dhamma in such a way as this? Here, when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. Here, when someone feels a certain kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of painful feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. Here, when someone feels a certain kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase in him and wholesome states diminish. But when someone feels another kind of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase." It's a bit confusing. The former type of pleasant feeling is a sort of pleasant feeling that increases unwholesome states. They're sort of based on the household life. And the latter is a pleasant feeling where one feels a joy based on renunciation. So that unwholesome states diminish, wholesome states increase. This is a standard kind of measuring stick all through the Buddha's teachings. You know, whether it's keeping precepts or meditating or holding views, rather than saying, is this absolutely right or absolutely wrong when you hold a view that everything's impermanent? Because it's not a sure thing. Because you can grasp it in a way that unskillful qualities will increase and wholesome ones will decrease just because the way you're holding it. Because you can experience what is pleasant and joyful, and it doesn't have to create unwholesome qualities. It can be a source of wholesome qualities increasing. So that your whole practice, if you're thinking in terms of how do I measure or decide where to put my attention and effort, it's always around the increase of wholesome qualities, the decrease of unwholesome qualities. And the word kusala and akusala are words that are really worth researching or figuring out, because it has so many connotations, both in terms wholesome, skillful, beneficial, associated with calm and clarity, or associated with being disturbed and agitated. So there's the whole range of connotations that are packed into this, these words kusala and akusala. The Buddha goes on to say, good bhikkhus, and if it were unknown by me, unseen, unfound, unrealized, uncontacted by wisdom, again, going through these, I mean, it is a bit confusing how it's written. Sometimes the Buddha is making sure it's absolutely clear, but it's hard to follow sometimes. But what is it when you experience a pleasant feeling, if the unwholesome states increase and wholesome states diminish, and I'd say abandon such a pleasant feeling, would that be appropriate? Would it be fitting for me, not knowing that or not seeing that, not explaining that properly, to say abandon this? And he said no. But he said, the Buddha is saying, because it is known by me, seen, found, realized, contacted by wisdom, here when someone feels a certain kind of pleasant feeling, unwholesome states increase, wholesome states diminish. Therefore, I say, abandon such a kind of pleasant feeling. And so it's the Buddha saying, you know, abandon that which, whether it's a pleasant feeling you're experiencing, whether it's something unpleasant, somewhat painful, something difficult, whether it's neutral. But if the unwholesome states increase, wholesome states diminish, then that needs to be let go of, that needs to be abandoned. And if the opposite is true, unwholesome states decrease, wholesome states increase, then that's something you want to be putting your attention on, you're putting your effort on. Because even if it's, you know, a bit difficult or not so comfortable, the benefit is coming through the development of those qualities of mind, the wholesome and the skillful. Bhikkhus, I do not say of all bhikkhus that they still have work to do with diligence, nor do I say of all bhikkhus that they have no more work to do with diligence. I do not say of those bhikkhus who are arahants with taints of sword, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? They have done their work with diligence. They are no more capable of being negligent. That's quite a powerful statement in that sense of just pointing to that. The accomplishment is the accomplishment in having done what needs to be done. I say of such bhikkhus who are in higher training, whose minds have not yet reached the goal and who are still aspiring to the supreme security of bondage, that they still have work to do with diligence. Why is that? Because when those venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate it with good friends and nurture their spiritual faculties, they may, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. Seeing this fruit of diligence for these bhikkhus, I say that they still have work to do with diligence. And then it goes into the whole different template of realization. 7 o'clock already, so to be continued.